Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Three, two, one. Hey, I'm Chad Abumrad.
And I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radio Lab, and today. Blood.
I'm told we're going to get some pretty cool donors today. So here we go.
All right, so there are places in the country where people give a lot of blood, like Minneapolis, Minnesota, or Columbus, Ohio.
All right, that one goes in the paper bag here.
Where if you go to a blood drive, and we did.
Hey.
Hey.
Name, today's date, and a phone number on there is all.
Okay.
You'll find a really comforting scene. People with busy lives taking a moment to walk into a cubicled room, sit down with some nurses.
Now, just iodine at all?
No.
Stick out their arms.
All right, you ready for the fun part here?
Yes.
And then I'll just mark your vein just to make sure I know exactly where I need to go, stick it in, and save some lives. How about that?
I'm super excited.
And
now's the time to look away.
Okay. You're not like to watch.
Ow. Beautiful. Okay, that kind of hurt.
Sharp. It did hurt?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
And one by one, they drain their own blood, sometimes a double dose.
You give double the amount.
Yeah, like this guy.
Well, I do feel a little woozy.
All to help strangers they will never meet. And if you ask these folks,
why do you donate?
You'll get the answers you expect and that you hope for. You know, well, because...
why wouldn't you? It's selfish not to.
It's the right thing to do.
Being healthy, I have a responsibility.
I thought about a person in need in the hospital.
My mom used to work in neonatal ICU. She always tells stories about the babies that needed blood transfusions, and it always just made me think of, like, if I had a kid, I would really want blood to be there for them to have blood.
I mean, the simple point is that giving blood is a gift, right?
It's the most selfless thing you can do. It's the most loving thing you can do.
It's the gift of life.
You can't give any greater gift than that.
That's the message we've gotten in PSAs for the last half century. But if you poke into it, as if with a big long needle.
And if that long needle is named Molly Webster.
And Soren Wheeler.
Well.
You will find that the reality is way more...
complicated.
Way more complicated.
Okay, this is him. This is Gilgal.
We should just say, first of all, that this whole story started for us with this guy.
Okay.
Gilgal, he's a longtime newspaper reporter.
And now I'm retired and I write books.
Gilbert Gall, retired newspaper man.
I worked 40 years in newspapers.
And the story that Gil ran into actually started back in the late 1980s.
What happened was Red Cross would come to our office.
To do blood drives.
And I literally was giving blood one day.
Sitting in the chair with a needle in his arm.
And the blood was draining out of my arm into the bag.
And a very simple question popped into his head.
I wonder what happens to this stuff after, you know, it gets into this bag. It was just, who knows why I was thinking this? I certainly don't remember, but I suggested to Craig Stock, my editor, hey, you know, why don't we just do a little explainer about blood for a Sunday piece?
Just a short little thing about what happens to the blood, how it's processed, where it ends up.
He said, sure, go ahead. And so I called up the local Red Cross, set up an interview with the executive director of the blood center there. And I went up to see this guy. And the strangest thing happened. Before I could even ask any questions, he started in at me wanting to know why I wanted to know this stuff. What was the purpose? Why was I coming after Red Cross? He was just extraordinarily defensive. And for me as a reporter, I mean, my antennae are going up. And that's how it all started.
At that point, what was supposed to be a nice little Sunday piece about the gift of life turned into a crazy story filled with
hospital contracts,
money and salaries, and business and economics,
pharmaceuticals,
verbal assaults,
commercial enterprises.
I absolutely had moments when I would sit back and say, oh my God, I can't believe this is going on.
What? What
are you
talking
about? I'm going to tell you in 1 second. Maybe 2 minutes. But first, you should know that historically, there's always been like a tension in the way we think about blood.
Huh. Tension.
Yeah. So I'm going to rewind.
When blood was first being used, it was during war times, during World War I.
That's Scott Carney. He's the author of the book, The Red Market.
And it hit big business in the Battle of Cambrai.
That was the very first time medics realized they could use preserved blood, have it on the battlefield at the ready anytime they wanted it.
So you could keep your troops alive longer if you had blood available.
Still, the blood didn't last very long, and the process of giving blood was pretty gruesome and painful. But by World War II and into the Korean War, we'd gotten much better at storing and transporting blood, and giving blood was less painful, which meant people back home could get involved.
What happens is there are these massive ramp-ups.
You can give these men the gift of life, a pint of your blood.
To get blood to the battlefield.
The Department of Defense is calling for all Americans to roll up their sleeves.
For the first time, you saw these amazing magazine advertisements, showing a soldier on one knee holding his rifle, and it said, he give his blood, will you give yours?
That's Douglas Starr, author of the book Blood.
An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce.
In Britain, there was this idea, we're being bombed. We want to do anything we can do to help the war effort. Now, in the United States, there was a voluntary donation system, but there was also this saying, hey, we're Americans, let's make some money on it. As well. So what happened in the States is that you had these two systems. You had the voluntary sort of Red Cross model, and you also had these places that would pay you
anywhere from $15 to $40
for your blood.
Really?
Yeah. All over the country, usually in the Skid Rows.
It's Skid Row shanty towns.
People are setting up these for-profit blood centers, and they're paying people for their blood. People called them booze for ooze.
Ooh.
Because they were often set up next door to liquor stores, and sometimes instead of in money, they would pay in chits redeemable at liquor stores. So you can imagine the population they attracted.
According to one eyewitness account,
there were worms on the floor. It was a dirty, dirty business. Like your first college apartment. It was just a really, really bad place. And
I think it was probably worse than my first college apartment.
I know. I was like, worms on the floor. I don't know where you were living, Scott, but worms weren't really the problem. I mean, on the one hand, these paid places
got a lot of blood. The volumes were quite high.
But pretty quickly, doctors and hospitals, they started to notice that
paid blood is lower quality than altruistic given blood.
Because you're attracting people who are down and out.
Might have disease.
A lot of infections. A lot of hepatitis.
And if they were sick, they'd still want to get paid, so they'd lie about it.
Prisoners were giving blood. The state of Arkansas funded its whole prison system on blood sales.
And of course, everybody from the blood bankers to clergy people are saying this is obscene. There is something sacred about blood. It's not a commodity. It's a holy substance.
And so by the late 60s, the early 70s, people were saying, no more paid blood. We need to get rid of it. All blood should be donated. It should be given freely. And it was partly about making blood safe, but it was really about more than that.
In addition to just being safer, an altruistic blood supply brings the society together. Because when you're giving blood out of altruism, you are saying ultimately, I'm doing this for the society in general. I'm doing it for the war effort. I'm doing it because I'm an American. And that it has this other effect that brings a whole nation together.
So today, there's no more paid blood?
No paid blood.
So no money involved?
Well,
kinda. Which brings us back to Gil.
I want to know a little bit more about how this works. And so what happened?
After his conversation with the Red Cross guy, Gil went out, he got a list of all the blood banks in the country, and he just started going down the list.
I would call one a day or call two a day and ask them, what do you charge for a unit of blood?
What do you charge?
Yeah,
this was one of the surprises. It turns out right after they draw the blood,
it feels kind of, the tube feels warm.
Because it's coming right out of your body.
Right after, they'll put it in a bag.
Keep it on ice.
package it up.
And they will sell that pint of blood to a local hospital.
Yep, so we do have different contracts with different hospitals, different blood centers.
I believe right now it's like almost $300 a pint is what they sell it for.
That's insane. I was thinking $5. Yeah.
No. We should say 300 is actually kind of a, like a rough average for most major cities.
Right. And theoretically, the price that the hospitals pay the blood center is it's just to cover costs. And there are a lot.
The salaries, the bags, the testing, the distribution, business office, public relations.
That's just a partial list that one former blood banker gave us. But that's really what Gil wanted to understand. You know, when someone donates a pint of blood, what does it cost to process that blood? And then what do you turn around and sell it for?
And some of the places were shocked by the question. Some of them would say, there's no way on earth we're going to tell you. Some of them would say, oh, you know, we charge $48 a unit.
So he made a list.
On a legal yellow pad.
Of all the different prices the blood banks would charge their local hospitals.
You might see at that time as low as the low 30s and as high as $70.
And you wondered, you know, why the variation?
Some of it was explainable. You know, labor costs are higher in Los Angeles, New York. So that made sense. But where that got interesting was...
He says he just happened to be talking to some blood banker, probably a guy from the Midwest.
Maybe about prices.
And the guy just casually mentions that his blood bank actually gets way more blood than it needs.
Yeah.
They had a surplus. And they told him...
What we do is, you know, we take that blood...
And we sell it to other blood banks.
We sell it to somebody who can't collect enough. And I probably reacted like, what?
And that led him to call up a blood bank in a little town called Appleton, Wisconsin.
In Appleton, they...
That blood bank at the time was pulling in plenty of blood, way more than they needed.
Oh, yeah.
Locally.
And I knew that Appleton had no trouble collecting plenty of blood.
And yet...
Around the holidays...
The director himself was quoted in the local paper saying, like,
oh gosh, we can't collect enough blood. You know, we're pleading with you to come in. We've never had it so tough.
And Gil basically asked the guy, why are you saying this? You're doing fine.
I did what any reporter would do. I began to press him on some numbers. He acknowledged that half of the blood they were collecting in Appleton was actually being sold to other blood centers.
Appleton was taking a chunk of that blood, marking it up $10 a pint, and selling it to...
To, I think it was Lexington, Kentucky. I called Lexington, Kentucky.
They were taking that blood, taking out the platelets, and then selling the red blood cells...
To Broward.
Broward County, Florida.
So I then called Broward.
And he found out that Broward was marking it up $20 more a pint and selling it
to New York City, which is always looking for blood. They could never collect nearly enough blood.
Basically, what he discovered was that the whole gift economy of blood, that was only on the bottom
I'm
level.
Just feeling the direction at the vein right now. It's nice and plump.
It was only down there.
You have an absolutely gorgeous vein in here. Absolutely gorgeous.
I do.
You do. Do. Do.
As soon as you moved up a rung,
it was a market.
Blood was being bought and sold and marked up.
At every step of the way.
And this was, so we're talking late 80s here. This is...
Yeah, late 80s, yeah. 88, 89.
And is this still going on?
Oh, yeah.
And it's huge, huge business.
I looked at the Red Cross tax return yesterday just to refresh my memory. When I was writing about them, their blood business was a $500 million a year business. It's now a $2.1 or $2.2 billion a year business.
And it's not just the Red Cross. I mean, the Red Cross does like half of the blood collections in the United States, but there are small independent blood banks all over the country. And we pulled some of their tax forms, and they have revenues of $30 million over there. There's $70 million over there. Some of them are $50
million. When I left the blood center, we were at the time about $90 million a year blood center.
So this is Charles Ruault.
I have been in blood banking actually since about 1973.
And more than any other guy we talked to, he really gave us a feeling for the business side of the blood business, especially
in South Florida.
In South Florida in the 80s and 90s, you had kind of an unusual situation because you had a bunch of different blood banks.
There was a program in Miami-Dade. There was one in West Palm Beach.
All these different programs competing for the same donors.
You might anticipate there would be some competition, but you didn't think that you could ever see anything like South Florida.
Things became quite heated.
The heads of the blood banks attacked each other in the press.
In the press, in the local stories, yeah.
They got into crazy bidding wars over access to high school students.
The Great School Board War, yes.
They accused each other of
stealing donors, underpricing their products in order to gain market share.
One morning I would go to work.
That's Peter Tomasulo. He was one of Casey Ruault's competitors.
And I would find that one of our hospitals had been visited by Casey and his team, and they had given us notice that they were going to switch to Casey. That feels horrible.
Well, it's business.
At a certain point, the competition, says Casey, got so intense
that I got a number of ugly phone calls from people.
Saying what?
We're going to bury you.
We're going to bury you?
Mm-hmm.
In that case, the call came from a New York blood bank. Casey had decided that the only way he could compete in Florida and the only way he could keep his blood from going bad was to take his blood up to New York, sell it to New York hospitals at way below market value.
So we were undercutting the blood supplier in New York at that time.
And they didn't like that.
No, but
it worked.
We became known sort of as the Golden Arch to New York.
He eventually figured out that he could buy blood on the cheap from a place like, say, I don't know, Iowa, and sell it up the chain to New York.
So you really did become kind of a
blood runner.
Well, we called it arbitrage.
Arbitrage, yeah, it's exactly arbitrage, isn't it?
We were arbitraging the units.
I mean, that's in Wall Street, that's like the most cutthroat of the cutthroat are arbitragers.
Yeah, but we're talking here about blood. And do you throw it away or do you find a home for it?
Casey says if he hadn't done that, he would have had to pour that blood down the drain.
If you're running a blood center, you have an obligation to make sure that the promise that you made to that donor is fulfilled, that your unit is going to go to take care of somebody who is sick. Throughout the blood banking industry, I have yet to bump into somebody who wasn't motivated by that promise.
Even the guy on the other end of the phone call who said, I will bury you? You think he had the same motivations as you?
Yeah. Actually, it was a she.
Oh, really?
And here's the thing. Like, at a certain point, I mean, Molly, I think you'll agree that, like, we started to feel kind of differently about this whole blood business, blood system kind of stuff.
Molly, do you agree about that?
I do agree.
I mean, like, we've talked to, how many blood bank people have we talked to?
Oh, God.
Tons.
Yeah.
I have to say, like, these guys are not, you know, they're not that cutthroat Wall Street person. Like, talking to them, they're not like that. I mean, they're stuck with a reality that demands that they act in business-like ways.
But not to be intentionally naive here. Like, I know businesses have to run like businesses, but there's some part of me that just doesn't want blood to be a business. It shouldn't be a business.
Well, I mean, maybe you need to let go of that idea.
Yeah, I found, like, I kept reporting this, and I kept saying, why did everyone keep telling me it was a gift if it's kind of this commodity that everyone's shuttling around? Why don't we just call it what it is? We keep hiding behind this idea of a gift. I would still donate. I don't think I care.
You know, maybe we need to let a little bit of that gift image go.
I mean, there is something wonderful about giving. And I think one of the touching things to see was how after 9/11, so many people rushed to give blood. And after the Boston Marathon bombing, so many people rushed to give blood. Unfortunately, especially after 9/11, that was based on an old-fashioned idea that no longer is valid.
And it may actually be harmful, according to Douglas Starr. Take 9/11.
What happened after 9/11 is all the politicians said, give blood. The Red Cross kept saying, giving blood. But the people in the know, the other blood bankers, were saying, no, stop. Stop. We can't use it. Wow. You know, I spoke to the head of the Blood Bank of New York, Ground Zero. He said, as soon as I saw the plane hit the building, I thought, we're not going to be able to use that blood.
Wow.
They had huge lines. All of the facilities got overwhelmed all over the country.
A lot of the facilities ended up having to pour a lot of blood down the drain.
Blood went bad, but there was this other rebound effect, and that is if you've stood online to give blood and they came out and said, you know what, go home, we don't need you, psychologically you feel that you've done your thing. So 6 months later, in the winter season, during Christmas, when they usually have lows, they had historic lows because nobody would come out to give.
Oh, because they were like, oh, we gave blood, they were full.
Yeah, I did my civic responsibility. So the final stage is we really do have to understand that this is a pharmaceutical.
That might be another way to think about blood. I mean, it's a drug. It's not simply a gift that I can choose to give or not give. It's a precious raw material, and I'm the only one who we are the only ones who have it. And when it comes out, yeah, some people make some money on that. And yeah, they could definitely be more upfront about that.
I wish they were a little more transparent.
Definitely. But I'm the only one who has this stuff. And when I stop to think about how powerful this drug, this pharmaceutical really was, I kind of decided maybe I should give.
That is a really big one.
So make a fist and hold. You're okay. Going to turn your head on the other side if you don't want to look. And you're going to feel a pinch, okay? Don't move your hand. Okay, take a deep breath. Open your hand.
Thank you for being my first nurse, donor nurse.
Producer Soren Wheeler, Molly Webster.
Okay.
Special thanks to Rachel Quimby and Anna Wegel. And also Edward Scott and Jeff McCullough. And before we go, we actually had the Brooklyn band Lucius play a couple of Blood songs that we use in this episode. You might have heard one earlier. Here it is. Well, you can get that blood song from Lucius plus one more on our website, radiolab.org. It's a free download. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Scott Carney.
This is Dan Tracy.
And I'm calling to leave a message about you guys, for you guys, on the radio.
So here you go.
Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad.
Our staff includes Ellen Horn, Soren Wheeler, Pat Walters,
Tim Howard, Brenna Farrell, Molly Webster,
Melissa O'Donnell, Dylan Keith,
Lynn Levy, and Andy Mills.
With help from Matt Tinsey, Kelsey Padgett, Derek Clements, and Shruti Finamani.
Special thanks to Ania Burgess, Amy Wagers, Francesco Lofredo,
Stefan Anderson, and Barbara Johansson.
And Joe, take through the heart. Love it. Goodbye, Radio Lab. Goodbye.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.